Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Walking is good. You can get 10,000 steps a day, no matter what combination. That really adds up to something good for your health.
Never quit radio. All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. Thank you guys for tuning in, and please don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button wherever you are getting this show. So today, before we get to our special guest, let's kick it off with our weekly Patreon question. And this week, we've got, what is something that you think should be taught in high school that is not taught right now? What's something beneficial?
Taxes.
I was going to say taxes too.
I think, you know, we need to do a better job with American history and to make all kids aware of and proud of our heritage. Whether we go back to the American Revolution or World War II, the growth of our great country into a world power. As you know, most kids walking around are not very knowledgeable of our history. So that would be one thing that I would promote.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I'd say manners. Civility, and manners, that class. Like how to properly address somebody, yes sirs, no sirs, and all that. Just basic overall discipline and manners.
I also think they should bring back home ec. Like just your basic, for girls, do home ec, for guys, do shop. Like at our school where our kids go, they don't teach that. There's no life skill. So I think that would be really good, too. What about you, Hunter?
I got that when I was a kid, and we got auto shop, and we learned how to type.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, our kids have those. Typing, but they don't have any kind of hands-on trades skill, and there's no home ec. So I think that needs to be brought back. I don't know about our kids aren't in public school, so I don't know what the public schools are doing, but the private schools aren't doing that.
Do they still have gym?
Yeah, they have PE.
Every school does?
Yeah.
That's mandatory.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Maybe a class where you don't have any tech.
We learned manners from our coaches. I'm sure you did.
Oh. Oh, man, absolutely.
That's where I got mine.
Our coaches made us cut our hair, and every Friday we had to wear a tie to school.
Oh, that's a good one.
Our coaches were the ones that would swat you with the paddle. Like, if you got in trouble with any of the teachers, they'd go get the coach. And as soon as that sucker walked in, you were like, oh, man. And they didn't care. You got to have those tough men walking around, those coaches that they're like the police in there. They keep everybody in check. That's what their job is.
Yeah.
Or was. That's a good question. All right, Colonel. Thank you again for coming on. We're gonna kick this off. First of all, thank you for your service. Once a Marine, always a Marine. But I'd like to know where you came from, if you wouldn't mind telling me a little bit about that.
So I'm a New Englander. I was a son of a World War II era and Korea Marine. So that had a big influence on me. And so we were imbued with much of the heritage that's associated with Boston, the Revolutionary War, Paul Revere, and actually getting ready to go back to the Boston Marathon. It's going to be the 250th anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, April 19, 1775.
Wow. That's awesome.
And you had a history of military, and you said your dad served. Anybody else?
Well, like most people at that time, just about everybody served. So I had two vets. I had great uncles that were World War I vets. And I had a cousin, my cousin Joe, who was a Vietnam era vet. We were pretty close.
And do you have any siblings?
So, Melanie, I grew up with five women in the house.
Oh, nice.
Four sisters and my mom, one telephone and one bathroom.
Oh, gosh. I know that was chaos.
What got you into the military? Why the Marine Corps?
So, as a little boy, my dad, when I was born, and when I began to realize what was going on, I used to follow my dad around like a puppy dog. And he loved having me around him, but he tended to hang around with other Marine veterans. And I think that's because, you well understand, nobody quite understands what it's like to be a SEAL unless you're hanging around with other SEALs. And I think for him, other Marine World War II vets, it was kind of his comfort zone. So those men would be around, and I just idolized those veterans as a young boy, 5 or 6 years old. And my dad would let me sit there and listen to their conversations about life, about sports. So I understood that these men, these Marine veterans, were different from the other dads. And many of those dads, most of those other dads, were also veterans of other services. But I realized that these Marines, there was something different and kind of special. And so there came a point where I told my dad, that's what I want to be. I want to be a Marine like you. And he said, if that's what you want to do and that's how you want to spend your life, then you'll do it a little bit different from me. There's a place called the U.S. Naval Academy, and if you get good grades and you're a good athlete, you might have the opportunity to go there. And I think at the time they touted it as a $100,000 education, which was kind of impressive. And so that gave me a goal, and that kind of drove me as I was coming up, junior high school, high school. That was my dream. But at the same time, It seemed like a really lofty dream, and I was never sure that I could actually achieve it. So there are a lot of young boy prayers that were answered, and fortunately I was able to get nominated and accepted and went through and didn't get booted out.
That's awesome. It's a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, I love the Naval Academy. I don't push the military on my sons, but I want my sons to go there. I would love for him to go there. And I'm on him, and his mom are on him about his grades. We even hint at it. Like, hey, the Naval Academy would be a good place for you. You can become a doctor. You can become a combat. You can be a SEAL. You can be a Marine. You can do anything out of there.
Mm-hmm. Pilot?
Yeah, pilot.
When you bring your child there, they'll get a feel for the place. And if the chemistry is there, they'll know it. And that'll really inspire them. And there are some really good programs. You may be aware of them. They have a variety of summer sports camps that you can go as a camper, even as young as maybe 9 or 10 years old. So you can go to a baseball camp, a wrestling camp. And for high school students, they have a STEM camp where they go and they can do academics. So they get exposed to the facilities. They get exposed to the academics and the professors. And it leaves no doubt whether that's the place that they want to spend 4 years at or not. The sports program, we sent Patrick to swimming camp. I think we sent him 4 years total. And he just loved it, lived in Bancroft Hall, which is the barracks there, and got exposed to, you know, collegiate level swimming coaches. It was wonderful.
That's amazing.
It is. When I was growing up, they didn't really promote the academies at our school. I didn't know anything about them. And then if you did hear about it, it was almost impossible to get into there. Just because of what it is.
Like too hard to even try.
Yeah, to even try. Yeah. Don't even sign up for it. Mm-hmm. But once I made it in there and I got to see the place, same way with West Point. And as a Navy guy, I know it's a big deal, but they got a beautiful facility up there. If you've never been able to visit any of the academies, and the Air Force Academy is in Colorado.
Yeah.
I mean, typical Air Force, you know, they got a beautiful place in the mountains. But if you're out there if you're looking for a university, man, the academies are definitely a way to go. When did you come out of there?
Yeah, I was 1977.
And you picked being a Marine when you were in the academy, correct?
So I had the option of being commissioned Navy or Marine, and I went in there with the intention of being a Marine, and you had to be a little bit careful with that because the Navy side of the house, if they knew that you were aspiring to be a Marine, they thought that you were kind of like a lost boat space, so you kind of had to low-key it a little bit, but there were so many great Marine mentors there that were on the faculty. That really kind of kept us motivated.
Okay, so when you came out of the academy, where'd they send you?
All Marines who are commissioned, whatever the source, they go to Quantico for 6 months for the basic school. In my case, I was selected for infantry, so I had a follow-on school, the infantry officer course. And when I entered the Naval Academy, it was 73, so Vietnam was still kind of winding down. And I wanted to go where the action was. And at the time, the action still seemed to be out in Westpac. And so I got sent to Okinawa to 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, and started as a platoon leader.
How was that?
It was awesome. First of all, I want to back up. You know, considering the era, one of the great Navy heroes was there on the staff after he got released as a POW, Admiral Stockdale.
Yeah.
And so we all had the opportunity to kind of get to know him and be inspired by him. But Okinawa was terrific because it was, you know, unaccompanied tour. And I was very lucky because, you know, a new second lieutenant, you're really dependent on your staff NCOs. And they're the ones that guide you and keep you out of trouble. And in my case, Sergeant Will Green, who I'm still in contact with, you can imagine this new second lieutenant, his staff sergeant, had already had 2 tours in Vietnam and 2 tours on the drill field and 2 Purple Hearts. And so that was the staff NCO who guided me and got me off to a real good start on my Marine Corps career.
Yeah, I've always heard that, especially in the Marine Corps. Those sergeants, they're the ones that run that sucker, man. They keep everybody's ass in check all the way up to the top and all the way to the bottom. The corporals are a big deal. You got a squared away corporal. That's awesome. It's like, but if someone walks up to you and they're like, I was a sergeant in the Corps, and they're like, all right, check, roger that. And then if you know he's been in combat and has that ass shot up, he's got some Purple Hearts, and the drill sergeants are something, because they're a Marine. That's what I mean, like the hat, the whole 9 yards, the square jaw, and just freaking light you up. I remember that for sure. Yeah, it's a good time. How long were you out there?
So it was a 13-month tour, and before the end of my tour, the monitors, the career managers came out, and they were trying to get officers, company grade officers, to go to the drill field because there had been some problems. And they started a program where each recruit series mandated that they have two series officers rather than one to try to prevent some of the abuses that were going on. So my career manager came out, my monitor, and he said, Hank, you're probably going to be going to the drill field. If you volunteer, I'll give you a choice of where you can go. You can choose Parris Island or San Diego. So I'm a bachelor and, you know, Naval Academy, at those days, no women. Actually, my last year, the first group of women came in. But being out in Okinawa, social life wasn't great. I said, send me to San Diego.
Mm. Amen. Amen.
So about a month later, my orders came, and the order said, Parris Island.
Oh, no.
So I'm back there in Okinawa, call back to D.C., talk to the captain, the monitor, and said, hey, sir, you said if I volunteered, you'd send me to San Diego. And he said, yep, I know. I lied.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Straight up. Yeah, that's straight up.
So Parris Island, and it was a terrific 3-year tour.
Oh, wow.
And those detailers are like used car salesmen. They can freaking get you anywhere. They'll say whatever. There's something. They need to be politicians after that.
Just like a recruiter.
Like the recruiters.
Oh, my God.
Man, the recruiters and those guys, the detailers, man, they can get you into anything. Whatever the needs of the military are. They are trained well, for sure. Absolutely. So, okay, so after how many years did you do in the Marine Corps?
So 4 years in the Naval Academy, 30 years in the Marines.
30 years. Wow.
Thank you for your service.
Yeah, that's a really huge accomplishment.
That's amazing.
So what are you doing now?
I am an instructor. We have a postgraduate program that teaches Marine Corps Command and Staff. And it's a requirement for all Marine Corps majors to get promoted to lieutenant colonel. So it's the major level professional military education that they're required. We have a campus here at Camp Pendleton, and we teach it in a blended format, which means they come here temporary duty for 4 weeks right up front, and then they go back to their duty station, back to their billet, back to their family, and continue for 6 months online. And then they return a second time for 6 weeks, do a final planning exercise, and graduate.
That's amazing.
So yeah. That's what we do.
And that's in San Diego?
Faculty, we teach the whole 10-month program. It's at Camp Pendleton, San Diego.
Oh, nice. That sounds like a great job.
It is. It's real good if you're single. It's great life if you're single, because all the traveling and the places you get to live, it's hard on the family. I know that for sure. I wasn't married, but the guys that I were around were, and you can tell, but it is. Okay, so I know that you run marathons.
I remember, Melanie, there was a period of time in the 1990s, we did 9 household moves in 7 years.
Oh my gosh. Your poor wife, that's a lot of stress on her.
Kind of can move quick, as we all know, on active duty.
Yeah, that's so much stress to be able to pack up and move your whole life that many times. You never know how long you're staying there.
Well, they say three household moves equals a fire.
Yeah.
So,
I don't think I've ever heard that, but that makes a lot of sense, though.
Yeah,
for sure. Okay, so you're a runner too.
So I'm a runner. Retired triathlete.
Did you start that while you were in?
What I like to say is that I wasn't a runner. I was a boxer at the Naval Academy. I was a football player in high school. And, of course, as you know, for those sports, the coaches make you get out there and run. But I like to say that the Marine Corps made me a runner. So being an infantry officer, you can't fall out. You can't fall back. And you got to look good in your uniform or you don't have any credibility. So what is there that gives you most bang for your buck, that you get the most for the amount of time that you invest in it. And I felt like endurance running was the thing that was going to give me that.
And how'd you start doing that? Just from the core, but then you went, how did you transition over to triathlete?
Well, first of all, for the Marine Corps, you know, our physical fitness test, part of that is a 3-mile run. So just training up for that. When I was at the basic school of Quantico, my captain, platoon commander there was a big marathoner. And he took us to, all of us, to our, my first race, my first sanctioned race, which was a Virginia 10-miler. And I really enjoyed that. But along with that, I always had in the back of my mind the marathon. So coming from Boston, when you're going through school, when they teach you about the history of Boston and our heritage, you know, we have the Red Sox, we have the Celtics, we have Paul Revere, and we have the Boston Marathon. And so just, you know, from your earliest memory, you know what the Boston Marathon is about. And I had a grandfather that ran it in 1916. So I always had this kind of dream of or ambition to run the Boston Marathon. So when I was at Parris Island, I found out about the Savannah Marathon, which back in 1980 was my first marathon race. So I trained up and I did that. And I said, you know, that wasn't too bad. I'd like to do another one. But then at the time, something that had gained a lot of notoriety was the Ironman Triathlon in Hawaii. And a couple of other buddies and I said, why don't we go do that? And so we looked at the calendar. We said, well, the next one is 3 months away. That's a little bit early to get ready for. But the next one is going to be in February 1982. So it was 16 months away. And so we started training. And so in the end, Parris Island sponsored me and sent me to Hawaii to run the Ironman triathlon in Kona in 1982. And it was the fifth Ironman. So it was still new, unique. A lot of people, if they know the Ironman and the history, they remember there was one Ironman where they had a woman, Kathleen McCartney, that crawled across the finish line just as the second woman passed her and beat her. And that was the Ironman I was in.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
So it was kind of the thing. Everybody at Parris Island knew that I was going. And doing the 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and a marathon at the end, you know, I said to myself, I can't fall out of this one. I have to finish, or I can't come back. And so there was a bit of pressure, and it turned out that I was the first Marine Corps finisher. I ended up doing actually pretty well.
Nice.
That's a great story, man.
Yeah.
Because the Kona one's a big deal. There's Ironmans everywhere, but that one's the Ironman.
So I did that, and I was pretty inspired, and I thought I might have a bit of a future in triathlons, and they were starting to talk about the triathlon being made an Olympic sport. And so with that idea of mine, I thought, I think I'm going to do my 5 years obligated service and get out and see if I can make the Olympics in the triathlon. So I came back from Kona. I went back to Parris Island. I had a new set of orders. I got sent to an infantry battalion, 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines at Camp Lejeune with this idea of continuing on with my triathloning. And it's funny how things work. I got back there and they were in the training cycle to get on the ships and go out to the Med. And I got back there and we did our pre-deployment training and got on the boats. And we sailed over and very shortly after leaving the East Coast, the Israelis invaded Lebanon. And it was the very beginning of the operations that occurred in Lebanon that we were involved in from 1982 to 1984. So the short story was that on that deployment, I ended up in Lebanon, and then we came back, and we were in the cycle to return, just in the rotation of units going in and out of Lebanon as peacekeepers. And it turned out that we got on the ships and we got ready to go back in 1983. At that time, I was now a captain company commander of Echo Company 2-8. And 5 days at sea, two things happened. It was a Sunday morning, October 23rd, 1983. Number one, the ships were heading south. They weren't heading east. And you know, Marcus, how a ship feels when it's going at full power, it kind of shakes.
Mm-hmm.
So we were on a new course and we weren't headed towards Lebanon. And then we also got the message in that the barracks in Beirut, the Marine barracks, had been bombed.
Oh, yeah.
And our sister battalion had been hit. It turned out to be 241 sailors and Marines that were killed there. So we got that news, and we also got the warning order that President Reagan was sending us into Grenada. And 48 hours later, we were on the ground there in Grenada. It was a 7-day op, and we got right back on the ship because we had to go out and relieve the battalion that got bombed. And so very quickly, we went across the water, did the relief in place there in Lebanon, and had 4 more months there with pretty much fighting every day. And so I think the whole point of all that was, whereas I thought I was on a path of finishing my Marine Corps career and going on to other things, that I was kind of swept up into events. Now here I was, a combat-hardened company commander that coming back with all that experience and all the emotional scars that come along with being a combat veteran. Life had gotten a little bit more serious and my career was a lot more serious. And so many lessons learned from Lebanon and Grenada that you just said to yourself, you know, there were some things that were done that shouldn't have been done, and they're not happening under my watch. And so it kind of became a conviction for me for the rest of my career that as my career went on, I want to make sure that I had the opportunity to teach the leadership and the skills that are necessary to go into combat, be successful, and then, you know, come home and be able to deal with the real world. You know, the idea of making sure your troops, your subordinate leaders have the resiliency to experience that and come back home and still be combat effective.
What are some of your wisdom that you can pass to me from there? 30 years of it, as far as leadership.
We got a Canadian major in this class. He's a special operations guy. And we've been talking lately about assumption of command. So these officers, their next command would be a battalion or a aviation squadron. And you know, some of the challenges that are inherent in command. And we have an adage that nice guys kill Marines. So it's everybody wants to be the popular guy and the likable guy. But there are some things that your inexperienced troops don't know. You have to enforce the law and you have to be a hard guy, you have to be a bit of a prick, and they don't really understand where that's coming from. But if you're not willing to do that and you let things slide, then people are going to get hurt and you're not going to take all your people home. So, you know, the very simple example in Beirut, there were some leaders who were willing to kind of cut the corners. We have these alert conditions, and in the alert conditions, if you're at a high alert, you're required to have your helmet on with the chin strap fastened and your flak jacket on and completely sealed up, not opened up to get a little bit of air in there when it was hot. And units where it was lax, the Marines would be around with their helmet just on their head without the chin strap on and the flak jacket open to let the air in. So we never knew when we would come under a barrage, a mortar attack, or rockets. And there was a group of engineers that were out playing football. And all of a sudden, the first round came in, and one of the Marines hit the deck, and the first thing that happened, his helmet rolled off. The next round came in, and a piece of shrapnel took the top of his head off.
Oh, gosh.
And there were other occasions where that shrapnel, you know how it is, it's going to find that little space, that opening, or it's going to go under your armpit, and it's going to get in there and get you. So leaders have to understand what the reason is for those things, those rules that we learn the hard way, and to be able to enforce them. And if you're dynamic enough, you can sell it. But the adage, nice guys kill Marines, is something that I live by and something I continue to teach.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Well, once you make it a sergeant in the Corps, you make it past 03, you guys get permission to be dicks. You're not supposed to be nice. Like, I don't think I ever ran across one that was. Anything and everything they said was on point. So now that you're out of the Corps and you're teaching, what else?
You know, there are a lot of little things, like the importance of fitness. They're working on something they call their philosophy of command. So it's the kind of idea that when they assume command, they articulate and they publish their command philosophy. And it pretty much stacks up their priorities of what they want to accomplish when they command and how they're going to achieve mission success. And so that's very kind of a personal thing. And one of the things I talk to them is about physical fitness. So going back to a lesson learned on Grenada, we landed on Grenada, and on the first day, first 24 hours, things were moving pretty quick, and we were racing right on the tail of the bad guys, trying to catch them when we seized Pearls Airfield, which was my company objective. And within the first half hour, I had a key leader who fell out from heat exhaustion. You may know that we have three categories of fitness. When we run our physical fitness tests, you can be a first class PFTer, second class, or a third class. This Marine was a third class PFTer. And within a half hour, his leadership was lost, and his number two had to fall in and take his place. And over time in other situations, I learned that how critical peak fitness was to leadership and combat leadership. So as an adage of mine and something when I did my philosophy of commands, I was in command twice as a battalion landing team, BLT commander, and then as a colonel, the CEO of Combined Arms Training Center, Camp Fuji, Japan. Then in both of those documents, and when I took command, I said, one of my priorities is physical fitness. If you're a leader, if you're an enlisted leader or an officer leader, you need to be able to lead from the front and have peak physical fitness. So that would be another one, Marcus.
We knew a Marine that was a World War II veteran, and he was in his 90s. He's passed away now, but in his 90s, he could still fit in his uniform. He was in perfect shape. I mean,
he looked just like he did when he came out of there, sir. Yeah. Let me tell you, I've run across three of them. One of them was 100, one of them was 99, and the other one was 93. And you could shave with the crease in that dude's pants. And I mean, he was buckled up with his gold and khakis. And I mean, like, no belly fat, nothing. I mean, I still had the buck, mowed the yard in just like a Marine. Everything he did, and that's the one thing about y'all, and no one can take that from y'all. Man, the way y'all carry yourselves in those uniforms, because I've never seen a fat one. It's a thing with y'all, and it's impressive. I don't compliment Marines a lot, and they know why, because it's a thing with Navy and Marine Corps, especially the SEALs. But I mean, whenever I was getting my ass kicked, y'all would show up, and then you'd show up looking good.
Yeah.
And I can't take that away from you. I freaking can't.
Well, Marcus, there's things about you that about being a SEAL and being a sailor that will be with you till the day you die.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I love that too, man. That stuff that happens just with in our communities. Like, you have to be part of us to understand that. We were talking about that earlier, and that's freaking one of them. And it has been for a long time.
So those are really good lessons. I mean, just for life, not only for leadership, but just in life. Tell us a little bit about the Semper Fi Fund that you're doing, that you're working with.
So the Semper Fi in America's Fund is something that I was trying to find meaning in my running. So back in 2012, I think I had 65 lifetime marathons. And I have this friend of mine. She's from Texas. She's from Dallas. Her name is Angela Tortorese. And she has the world record for the most marathons run by a woman. And back in 2012, she was aspiring to get the Guinness Book of World Record for the most marathons run by a woman in a calendar year. So she got in touch with me and said, "Hey, I'm coming out to California to run this marathon. And maybe you can come out and run a few miles with me." So at that time, I was running about 5 marathons a year, which is a lot. You know, most people would say that was a lot. But I was hitting this threshold where if I ran anything more than that, I would get injured and I'd be in the cycle of injury. So I was perplexed at how she could run all these marathons and not get injured. So anyway, I ran, I think, 19 miles with her during that race, and I was trying to get all of her secrets, and I said, "You know, how do you do it and not get injured?" And she said, "Hank, you just have to slow down. If you run slow, you won't get injured, and you can run as many marathons as you want and, you know, not have a problem." So I said, "Well, let me give this a try. I'm going to see if I can do 25 marathons in the next calendar year." And so that was 2013, and I did it, and I began to find out about all these marathoners who had, you know, 200 lifetime marathons, 500 lifetime marathons, 1,000 lifetime marathons. Angela right now, I think, has about 1,250 lifetime marathons.
Gosh.
So anyway, I was successful when I was starting to get into this group of people who, and, you know, it was a little bit of a fraternity, but I needed to find a little bit of meaning in doing all that. So you take time away from your family and other things in your life. And, you know, I said, "Is not going to be anything more than an indulgence unless I can find a meaning." And so I found the Semper Fi in America Fund to be able to run for wounded warriors and their families. And I could now say, now I've got a purpose behind all these marathons. And so that's how I got started. I've been doing it since 2014. And I'm just passionate about it because I've seen, you know, I've been able to take veterans in need and connect them with caseworkers with the fund and see them get immediate assistance. And whereas in many cases, you find a veteran in need and you go to other organizations and it's just a bunch of hype. They're really not there to do very much. On the contrary, the fund, they're right on it and they're committed. And, you know, most of their people are volunteers. They have very low overhead. So just about every dollar that I raise goes right back to the vets.
That's amazing.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. And now to you have Boston coming up.
So Boston is coming up on April 21st, and it's going to be the 250th anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. So that's a second benefit, but that's going to be my 500th lifetime marathon or ultra. So in that number, you know, I've run 100-mile races, 48-hour races, 100Ks. Regardless, if it was a 100-miler, it only counted for one of those 500. Wow. So God willing, number 500 will be on the 21st.
Wow.
That's a gift y'all have. I got buddies that are ultras. Yeah. My brother's one. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get that gene or that genetic. I even tried. I just, it's like one of those things. It's not what I didn't get that on the pass down. So the fact that you have that, how can we follow you and keep tabs on you while you're going through all that?
Help promote what you've got
what you're doing.
I think you can go to the Boston Athletic Association website and you can type in my name and follow me and see how I'm doing out there. I'll be as slow as a turtle. I'm going to be 70 years old in August. But if anybody wants to do that, they can see me make my progress.
Well, we're super proud of you.
Yeah. Thank you for everything throughout your life, for your service, for motivating all your up-and-coming Marines, and just to never stop running. Thank you for that.
If anyone wants to donate to the fund, where do they go?
They can just Google Semper Fi and America's Fund. And they can look for me or contact them and go to my donation page. My goal this year is to be the number one individual fundraiser for the fund. So, you know, if they look for Hank Donegan on there, go to my donation page. They can make a donation.
Awesome.
Yeah, well, thank you, Colonel.
Thank you for taking your time to tell us your story.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an honor, and I'm glad we have those connections and Eric and Murph.
Yeah.
One of the things I didn't get a chance to say, Marcus, is that, you know, you get a lot of solitude out of marathon running and ultra running. And so I try to be pretty open about my PTSD. So I'm 100% service disabled. And, you know, universally, almost every warrior comes back with at least a little bit of PTSD, but, you know, every 7 days I'm running at least the marathon distance, and I need that solitude. I need to get out there with God and nature, and it keeps me level. So I know, you know, you can identify with that, and I share that with others as a part of that resiliency, that if you're an active duty person, you know, and you're going to combat or you're been back from multiple tours to try to help keep things in check. It really helps me.
Yes, sir. I search for that constantly. And I finally wandered into a CrossFit gym, and just to stay busy, to keep beating on my body and just being around all that is helps me out considerably as well. I don't have the dynamic anymore to run in me. It actually injures me every time I try and do it. So I have to find something else to do. I hit the rowing machine a lot.
But you walk a lot.
And I walk. I walk a lot.
Walking is good. You know, they get the 10,000 steps. So both of you, you can get 10,000 steps a day, no matter what combination. That really adds up to something good for your health.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for the advice and the wisdom, sir. God bless you. Tell all the Marines to say what's up.
All right. God bless you both.
Bye. We'll follow your marathon.